Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Oklahoma Perspective. This summer will mark the 50th anniversary of the first moon landing by the U.S. When the space crew returned to Earth and splashed down in the ocean, John Wolfram was there to fish them out of the water. Recently, Wolfram was in town and stopped by to talk to KRMG's Russell Mills about the event and what he's been up to since then.
We're coming up to the 50th anniversary of what, for many Americans, was one of the defining moments of the 20th century, and that's when man set foot on the moon. I mean, that's big. And while you didn't get to go on that ride, you were definitely among those who welcomed these guys back to Earth.
That's correct.
When they splashed down in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Talk to us a little bit about that day.
Well, first of all, for a 20-year-old kid 2 years out of high school, I think it was pretty remarkable to even have that opportunity. Sometimes when you take that step, you graduate, you don't know what you're going to do. I just joined the Navy and things just opened up. But I was in Vietnam the year before. I remember sitting out on a barge down in the Mekong Delta Christmas Eve, listening to the radio there. And the station I was listening to was interrupted by the astronauts that were circling the Earth.
We're
and
orbiting.
they were reading from the book of Genesis. And at that point, I had no idea that when I returned to the United States that our underwater demolition team 11 would be chosen to be the next rescue team for Apollo 10 and 11. So that was a surprise. Being the first man in the water, I was a sea anchor man, so my job was to jump out of that helicopter by myself, swim up to the capsule. So I had the opportunity to look into the hatch window to see these three astronauts, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Mike Collins, for the very first time. They gave me a thumbs up. I gave a thumbs up to a helicopter above that had a NASA doctor in it. We wanted to make sure everything was okay. And then I attached a sea anchor, and actually it was a parachute, tethered underneath the capsule. Out in the ocean that day, the current was pretty strong. There was swells up to 6-7 feet. And if you don't stabilize the capsule, it's very difficult to put a flotation bladder around it.
6 or 7 foot swells, because yeah. They're bouncing around.
And so I was joined then in the water by two other frogmen that were waiting in the helicopter. They had a 200-pound flotation collar that they jumped in the water with. And because of this was the first moon landing, NASA had this back decontamination procedure going on, so we had to be on open scuba. Unfortunately, that tank was about 50 pounds, and that sea anchor was another about 7-8 pounds. And so I had to jump out of the helicopter and get over to that capsule with all that weight on. But once that parachute was inflated underneath, these two men and I put this flotation bladder around. I believe it was one of the Gemini flights that sunk out in the Atlantic. Mm. And from that day forward, they called on people like us to help secure the capsule so it wouldn't sink anymore.
Wasn't that
maybe it was a Mercury?
They think the astronaut blew the hatch, and so the capsule started to sink, and he always denied that he'd blown the hatch on purpose. I kind of know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
But excuse me. All right, so there was a reason it was Navy SEALs that was doing this work. Could not just have any yahoo. You know, swimming around with hundreds of pounds of gear and getting in, you know, trying to stabilize this craft so that they could extract those guys.
Well, we were well trained, that's for sure. Even on these recoveries, NASA sent a boilerplate out to San Diego. We rehearsed in the San Diego Bay with the helicopter crews. There was actually three rescue teams. Four frogmen in each team, three of us that put the collar around the sea anchor, and then there was that decontamination person that hit on a biological isolation garment. It was called a big suit. His job was to scrub down the capsule and the astronauts. So we had three of those teams, and the helicopters had three crews. And we must have rehearsed, 50 times before we got to Hawaii to board the USS Hornet. And then we did like 18 more rehearsals.
I was going to ask if you were on board the Hornet. Did you catch sight of the president?
No. We were out in the middle of the ocean waiting for the USS Hornet to pick us up. He flew in and flew out. He was on the Arlington, another ship that was there was actually 9 ships out there, 9,000 men to rescue 3 people that came back.
Well, part of the issue, if I remember right, is, they thought they had their math right, but this is the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And, you had to have a search team and a pretty large grid ready to go in case things didn't go exactly right. And then it seems kind of funny to modern ears, I think, but the idea that they had to scrub it down because they were worried about moon germs.
Well, here's the deal. The night before, there was thunderstorms in the area where the capsule was supposed to land in the ocean. So NASA changed the site 250 miles away, so the Hornet had to steam all night to try to get there. They were short about 10 miles. But when that capsule came back, it was only 18 seconds from the time that they thought it would hit the ocean. And it was less than 2 miles from the point where they thought it would land. And that's with a wind current. I mean, it's amazing to think they came back from the moon and they were able to accomplish
it
that
really
way back
is.
Then.
It's like they engineered somebody firing a .22 here and hitting something in St. Louis. I mean, it's
amazing.
It really is amazing. Yeah. That's quite a story. So you mentioned Vietnam sort of in passing. Oh, I was there in Vietnam, and heard the guys talking, reading Bible verses from space, which is, of guys of a certain age, because I'm old enough to remember some of this stuff.
Right.
This was earth-shattering. I mean, crazy, who would have ever thought kind of stuff that we were, the photo moonrise that one of the astronauts took. The idea that we could talk to guys in outer space. I mean, nowadays they just take it for granted. But there were no cell phones. There were no PC. It was a completely different world. So talk to me a little bit about your experience in Vietnam. It sounds like that was rough.
Well, being an underwater demolition team, mostly our job was to blow things up. They called us on special assignments to broaden streams so boats could get through, to blow up obstacles that the Viet Cong had put up to keep the U.S. Navy from going further inland. We dove down, retrieved dead bodies from boats that sunk, Americans that were down there that got killed. Various works, we manned machine guns and things on some of these river boats as the Navy Riverine Force was doing their job. After the Apollo, the 1960s was kind of weird. Woodstock, the era, Timothy Leary, the LSD, all those things that were taking place back in the 60s, the flower power. People decorated up those little minivans, and they drove off into the sunset, and girls had, flowers in their hair. It was kind of a hippie movement. And unfortunately, I got caught up in that drug scene after the Apollo. We were right there on the Mexican border, and a lot of my teammates were experimenting with things. And when I landed in Vietnam the second time, they put us up in a hotel room waiting for transportation down to the Mekong Delta. And I dropped some acid, and it was a really bad trip. And it turned into a nightmare. I almost took my life. These hideous voices took over, and cockroaches turned into monsters. And it was just a horrible scene. And I had just lost 3 high school buddies to the Vietnam War, and I was feeling pretty down about that time. I walked over to the bed, and I took out my 9mm pistol, and I had it pointed to my head. And that was my God moment, so to speak. There was just a little voice that spoke and told me to put it down, and that was the beginning of the journey. So Vietnam, when I was wounded a few weeks later, they sent me to a Army hospital in Cameron Bay, and this blew my mind. There were officers and enlisted in that environment. But during the films that night, they would show free entertainment. Officers and enlisted would walk around with big bags of drugs, selling them just like popcorn and candy during the movie. And I just couldn't believe how out of control that situation was over there. I know that that's not everybody's experience, but there may be some veterans out there that are listening today. And, you know, a lot of them came home and they really never got a healing. They carried some of this stuff with them for years and years and years.
Oh, but, absolutely. Yeah, but, I've spoken with several of them.
But by me being able to go back, I went back in 92. I was in Hanoi and some guy off the street, that's before all the tourism got over there. I guess they saw that I was Caucasian, spoke English. So I guess they assumed I was American. And some guy on the street just grabbed me, you know, an older guy, and I was thinking, well, maybe he's going to finish what he didn't do during the war. And he couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Vietnamese. But it kind of just dawned on me what he was saying. I think he was saying that, you know, hey, man, the war's over. I've moved on. How about you, you know? And by going back, it was very, very emotional. But by just looking at the former enemy and talking to them, they're humans, they're people. And without the uniform, without the war, everything was so different, you know, and it just made the whole difference to me that sometimes these wars are just crazy. After the war is over, you know, like Japan and Korea and some of those people meet on the street and talking, you know, but during that time, it's just a crazy, crazy moment, you know,
yep,
the war.
It is strange how it turns around. We fought our first war against England. We're good buddies with them. You know, our closest allies in Europe or Germany,
yeah,
and England, who does not consider itself a European country, mind you, have some English friends where they get a little iffy about that. And now in Japan, of course, I mean, we do not have a closer ally in Asia. And Vietnam, it's actually, that corner got turned fairly quickly.
Yeah.
You know, considering all of the years that we spent there. Why did you go back while you were still in the Navy? Were you simply assigned back or did you volunteer to go back?
No, I was, you know, I served 4 years, but I had time to do two tours, and it was just our rotation, and so.
So you were sent back.
I was sent back.
How were you injured?
I was on a riverboat, and was going down a real narrow stream, and the Viet Cong, they're in those tunnels and things, but they had water mines underneath, and they had B-40 rockets, and those things detonated. Our boat was hit with 8 of those B-40 rockets, and the boat was in such a condition it had to be towed back to its base because it was so damaged. Actually, there was one B-40 rocket just within inches of where I was behind this metal railing that had not detonated. You know, it's just strange things happen. But I made it out. When I was in a hospital recovering, by the time I left the hospital, I found out that 5 of my SEAL team teammates that were based there with me were killed.
Were they also on the boat? Or?
No, they not on that boat that day, but they were killed later. You know, when you're in a war zone, it's like Russian roulette. You wake up, you know, if you make it through the day, you just kind of thank the Lord, and then wake up next day and you hope you make it. When I left that hospital, you had to kind of hitchhike through Vietnam on those days to get back to the major bases to get that helicopter ride. I was on a civilian Piper plane with 2 businessmen, and we almost got wiped out of the sky. There was so much air traffic around that base that as they were taking off and getting their altitude, they had to dive down to miss some jets. And I just kept thinking over and over again, man, you know, there's so many ways to die over here.
And that is no lie, there absolutely were. So you basically describe having sort of an epiphany of you had a bad drug trip, which never good, had a gun in your hand, and you just felt like there was still...
When I was I was about 7 or 8 years old. My dad was an alcoholic, and he left my mother with 5 boys and a girl to raise. And, you know, it was kind of a rough time. I remember walking home from a store. I was collecting some pop bottles and pulling them in my little wagon. And I could take it to a little spot on that street where I lived where I heard a little voice that just said, John, I love you, and I've got a plan for your life. I mean, it wasn't salvation, but God knew my name. My dad had left us, but it was like God just reached down and gave me a hug that day. But in that hotel room, it was the same experience. It was the second time I heard that voice, just a little voice in my head that said, John, I'm here and I love you. And that's all it took. I put my gun down and just cried out and said, well, if that's you, God, deliver me from this war, you know, and these drugs, I'll do my best to serve you. It didn't happen overnight. When I got back to the United States, I didn't just run down to the first church and get saved. You know, I think human beings run from God as fast as they can. But he just kept working on me and kept talking to me. And one day I picked up a little newspaper and saw an advertisement that talked about a Pentecostal revival in the next community down there in Imperial Beach, California. And I went that Sunday night, and bang, God filled me with the Spirit. I was baptized in the name of Jesus, and I never looked back. In fact, I went back to my apartment that night, and I took a pillowcase and filled it up with marijuana and pot and LSD and pills and all the drug paraphernalia, and took it down to the San Diego Bay and baptized them. You just threw them away.
And so that led to a career as?
Well, I sure didn't expect to be doing what I'm doing today, but it was so profound. I just kept walking, and God called me into the ministry. I did missionary work for almost 25 years. You know, as a person that went to a foreign field, that we feel a call. There's a feeling that we have to different nations, and you know, I think it was 1983 when I actually submitted an application to start working. But you know, they built that Vietnamese memorial out in Washington D.C. about a couple of years
talking
before
about the
that.
Wall,
right? And people were writing books about their experiences, and all of a sudden, I just had this deep interest in knowing more about the war. And when I made that journey to Washington and saw that monument, it was so emotional. I had to get back. I had to go back. I was doing missionary work in the Philippines, and they had a refugee camp there where the Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians were escaping these communist countries by these little boats. And it was about an hour and a half from where I was stationed there in the Philippines working. And I went to that refugee camp and spent a couple of days, and it was so overwhelming, the love I had, the feeling for these people. I knew then that God wanted me to go back. You couldn't get into Vietnam at that time. It wasn't open for tourism.
Talking early 80s, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as soon as the door opened where you could get in, it's still a police state. The early days were kind of rough. You had to go as a tourist. You couldn't go as a missionary. You had to hide. People would pick me up early in the morning and put a little hood over my head and put me on the back of the motorcycle and drive me through the streets and dump me off at some building. And then the people would come, and we'd spend the whole day. And then when the sun set, they would put me back on that motorcycle and take me back to the hotel, because if I got caught, they would get in trouble and I would get in trouble. And those are interesting days, but exciting.
Yeah. So I'm guessing things have relaxed to a certain extent in Vietnam. I mean, I don't think
quite
they're
a bit.
Out hunting Christians in the streets.
Quite
at
a
this
bit.
Point.
Through the years, things have really improved over there. There's a lot of home churches. People have small groups of maybe 15, 20, 30 people that come to the home.
Kind of like the origins of Christianity, right?
Yeah, yes. Right.
They didn't have these great big buildings and stuff. It was basically folks getting together in their houses and kind of having to be a little subtle about it, in some cases flat out hiding, from True. Persecution or whatever, because it wasn't always the world's biggest religion, that's for sure.
The first time I went over there, the pastors that I were meeting had just come out of jail. They were imprisoned for their faith.
John Wolfram. Special thanks to KRMG's Russell Mills for the interview. This is Oklahoma Perspective. For Cox Media Group, I'm Bert Williams.